17.
At first, the revolution only gave the impression of being a historical event like any other, a matter for the press that might just possibly have some effect on the public mood. The Nazis celebrate January the 30th as their day of revolution. They are wrong. There was no revolution on January the 30th, 1933, just a change of government. Hitler became Chancellor, by no means the Führer of a Nazi regime. The cabinet contained only two Nazis apart from him. He swore an oath of allegiance to the Weimar Constitution. The general opinion was that it was not the Nazis who had won, but the bourgeois parties of the right who had captured the Nazis and held all the key positions in the government. In constitutional terms, events had taken a much more conventional, unrevolutionary course than most of what had happened during the previous 6 months. Outwardly also, the day had no revolutionary aspects, unless one considers a Nazi torchlight procession through Wilhelmstrasse or a minor gunfight in the suburbs that night as signs of a revolution. For most of us outsiders, the experience of January the 30th was that of reading the papers, and the emotions we felt while we were doing so. The morning headline was "Hitler Called to President." That produced a certain nervous, impotent irritation. Hitler had been called to the president in August and November. He had been offered the vice-chancellorship and then the chancellorship. Both times he had set impossible conditions, and both times there had been solemn declarations, "Never again." Each time, "never again," had lasted exactly 3 months. Hitler's opponents in Germany at that time suffered from a compulsive urge to offer him everything he wanted, indefatigably and at an ever cheaper price, indeed to press it upon him. It is the same now with his opponents outside Germany. Again and again this appeasement was formally renounced, and again it gaily reappeared at the crucial moment. Just so today. Then, as now, one's only hope was Hitler's own unreasonableness. Would it not sooner or later exhaust the patience of his opponents? Then, as now, it became apparent that their patience knew no bounds. At midday, the headline said, "Hitler makes impossible demands." We nodded, half reassured. It was only too credible. It would have gone against his nature to ask for less than too much. Perhaps the cup had once more passed from us. Hitler. The last defence against Hitler. At about 5 o'clock, the evening papers arrived. "Cabinet of National Unity formed. Hitler Reichschancellor." I don't know what the general reaction was. For about a minute, mine was completely correct. Icy horror. Certainly this had been a possibility for a long time. You had to reckon with it. Nevertheless, it was so bizarre, so incredible, to read it now in black on white. Hitler Reichschancellor. For a moment, I physically sensed the man's odour of blood and filth, the nauseating approach of a man-eating animal, its foul, sharp claws in my face. Then I shook the sensation off, tried to smile, started to consider, and found many reasons for reassurance. That evening I discussed the prospects of the new government with my father. We agreed that it had a good chance of doing a lot of damage, but not much chance of surviving very long. A deeply reactionary government, with Hitler as its mouthpiece. Apart from this, it did not really differ much from the two governments that had succeeded Brüning's. Even with the Nazis it would not have a majority in the Reichstag. Of course, that could always be dissolved, but the government had a clear majority of the population against it, in particular the working class, which would probably go communist now that the Social Democrats had completely discredited themselves. One could prohibit the communists, but that would only make them more dangerous. In the meantime, the government would be likely to implement reactionary social and cultural measures, with some anti-Semitic additions to please Hitler. That would not attract any of its opponents to its side. Foreign policy would probably be a matter of banging the table. There might be an attempt to rearm. That would automatically add the outside world to the 60% of the home population who are against the government. Besides, who were the people who had suddenly started voting Nazi in the last 3 years? misguided ignoramuses for the most part, victims of propaganda, a fluctuating mass that would fall apart at the first disappointment. No. All things considered, this government was not a cause for alarm. The only question was what would come after it. It was possible that they would drive the country to civil war. The communists were capable of going on the attack before a prohibition against them came into force. The next day this turned out to be the general opinion of the intelligent press. It is curious how plausible an argument it is, even today, when we know what came next. How could things turn out so completely different? Perhaps it was just because we were all so certain that they could not do so, and relied on that with far too much confidence. So we neglected to consider that it might, if worse came to worst, be necessary to prevent the disaster from happening. Through the whole of February 1933, everything that happened remained a matter for the press. In other words, it took place in an arena that would lose all reality for 99% of the population the moment there were no newspapers. Admittedly, enough occurred in that arena. The Reichstag was dissolved. Then, in a flagrant breach of the Constitution, Hindenburg also dissolved the Prussian Regional Parliament. There were fast and furious changes of personnel in the higher civil service, and the election campaign was accompanied by ferocious acts of terror. The Nazis no longer felt any restraint. With their gangs, they regularly broke up the election meetings of other parties. They shot one or two political opponents every day. In a Berlin suburb, they even burned down the house of a Social Democrat family. The new Prussian regional interior minister, a Nazi, a certain Captain Göring, promulgated an incredible decree. It ordered the police to intervene in any brawl on the side of the Nazis, without investigating the rights and wrongs of the matter, and furthermore to shoot at the other side without prior warning. A little later, an auxiliary police force was formed from the ranks of the SA. All this was still something one only read about in the press. You did not see or hear anything that was any different from what had gone on before. There were brown SA uniforms on the streets, demonstrations, shouts of Heil, but otherwise it was business as usual. In the Kammergericht, the highest court in Prussia, where I worked as a referendar at that time, the process of the law was not changed at all by the fact that the interior minister enacted ridiculous edicts. The newspapers might report that the constitution was in ruins. Here every paragraph of the civil code was still valid and was mulled over and analysed as carefully as ever. Which was the true reality? The Chancellor could daily utter the vilest abuse against the Jews. There was nonetheless still a Jewish Kammergerichtsrat, Kammergericht judge, and member of our Senate, who continued to give his astute and careful judgments, and these judgments had the full weight of the law, and could set the entire apparatus of the state in motion for their enforcement. Even if the highest office-holder of that state daily called their author a parasite, a subhuman, or a plague. Who cut the worse figure? Who was the butt of the irony of the situation? I must admit that I was inclined to view the undisturbed functioning of the law, and indeed the continued normal course of daily life, as a triumph over the Nazis. They could behave as raucously and wildly as they wished. They could still only stir up the political surface. The depths of the ocean of life remained unaffected. Entirely unaffected? Did not some of the surface waves send out vibrations, as evidenced by a new jittery tension? A new intolerance and heated readiness to hate, which began to infect private political discussions, and even more by the unrelenting pressure to think about politics all the time. Was it not a remarkable effect of politics on private life that we suddenly considered any normal daily private event as a political demonstration? Be that as it may, I still clung to this normal, unpolitical life. There was no angle from which I could attack the Nazis. Well then, at least I would not let them interfere with my personal life. It was partly this feeling of defiance that made me decide to go to one of the great carnival balls. I was not particularly in the mood for that kind of thing, but let's see if the Nazis can stop me enjoying the carnival.